February 25, 1981, California State University at Long Beach. Marvin Haney, interviewed by Kay Briegel.
It's interesting in the context of the university history.
Yeah, well, it's in when the campus first opened up, I was going to Long Beach City College, and there was a number of people at Long Beach City College in 1949. That we're talking about, you know, the campus, and I remember driving over to look at the apartment building that housed the campus on Anaheim Road, and it was kind of a chuckle, I guess, is the best way to describe it. The fact is, here was a temporary college that was, I believe the first name of it was Los Angeles / Orange County State College, and here it was housed in a an apartment building, and they had taken and put kind of a lean-to thing off of the garages for everybody to meet in between classes, and the end of that year there were a number of people that had went to City College that were transferred over here, and I knew a number of them. In fact, Dr. William O'Neill was one of those people, and his wife, Bev O'Neill, who's vice president of Long Beach City College now, were among those students that I went to City College with, and they came over here. And it was Korean War had started about this time, and I went from City College over to Fullerton Junior College because my parents moved over to the Sunny Hills area. And then I went in the service, and after I got out of the service, I had planned to go to USC. My older brother was at USC at the time, and it was kind of a fluke how I ended up in Long Beach. Because I had sent my transcript to SC, and somebody suggested I might send it over here too, and so I did. And SC, I had a problem with a couple of classes that they wouldn't accept junior college, and Long Beach would accept them. And what it amounted to is it would have taken me an additional semester to have gone to SC and going here. And I was, at the time, felt I was in a big hurry. I don't know where I was going, but I was in a very big hurry. And just, you know, I just, at that time, like so many people, just getting out of service, that I'd lost 2 years. And I realized you don't lose anything. There's always something to gain. But it took a few years to realize that. So anyway, I was in my big hurry, and so I came on campus in September of '54. And very interestingly, there was the campus was there were many, many people that I knew that I'd gone to high school with in the late '40s, and especially the men that got a service. There was a few girls that were in graduate school by this time that I'd gone to high school with too, and were continuing getting there. Primarily, the school as I saw it at the time, of course, was all on the lower campus in temporary buildings that had been built the year before. I guess when I was in the service is when the buildings were under construction. So when I came on campus, it looked like it was a very similar situation to what I saw in the service. It looked like a bunch of barracks. And so it was not that unnatural after coming out of the Army. So I was here, and we used to park our cars right where the student union is now. One of the great incidents, and you'll probably hear other people talk about, is the day that it rained and all the cars slid down the hill, and they had to get the tractor out. And the college had a tractor, the maintenance department had a tractor, and they were pulling all the cars out of the parking lot that were all stacked up at the bottom of the hill. All the ones in the top had slid down to the side. And I guess that was probably one of the most important events of the year. It had all kinds of ramifications on campus. and speeded up some additional parking lot construction. I don't even remember the size of the campus, but I'm sure it was 3,000 or 4,000 students at the time that I started here. The first freshman class, I think, started my at the same time that I started. It was either 54 or 55. The first freshmen showed up, and there was only a small number of them. And in fact, one of our leading citizens in Long Beach was in the original freshman class, Jim Gray, who's president of the Harbor Bank and Jim Gray Imports and is on the Harbor Commission in Long Beach. Very, very influential man. And he was in that first freshman class. So anyway, the school had a complete change. I would say that the allowing freshmen, adding a freshman class, changed the character of the school greatly. Before then, Kay, the was a lot of, like myself, a lot of veterans. I would say the average age of in the school of business at that time was probably 24, 25 years old. Almost everybody were, practically all men in there. In fact, there was only one woman I can remember in a lot of my classes. And I don't know why I remember her name, Joyce Niederberger. And my memory sometimes surprises me. I guess because of the fact she was the only woman in my business classes. It certainly changed from the day when there's many women in the school of business. But anyway, at that time, most of the students, particularly my first year, and it was an upper division, were older. There were many people even back then that were changing their field. A lot of people that had, especially in education, that had come back and got a teaching credential. They may have had a college bachelor's degree in art and decided they want to be an elementary school teacher. And at that time, Long Beach started off very strong as a primarily in education and was a very fine teacher training facility. It seemed like half the people on campus were in education. We had no permanent buildings. The first building, I believe, that was finished was the women's gym, which was used by everyone. The track was actually preceded that. They actually had the track facilities, because those were easy facilities to put in, and they used to change. They used one of the little bungalow for the facilities, for gymnasium facilities, and I'm not even sure whether they had had showers in the original facilities. I don't remember, but they were just a place to change clothes. So things were very, very primitive. In those years, the first buildings were under construction, and as I remember, the first buildings were completed in 55. And the initial buildings that were completed was the first element of the library, which was a single-story building. There was what was called LA 1 and 2 were completed, the Science 1 and 2 building were also completed. Those were the five buildings along with the bookstore, the first element of the bookstore, which was about 1/10 what the size of the bookstore is currently, were the completed buildings along with the one women's gymnasium on the lower campus. And that was the extent of the buildings that were completed while I was still on campus. The faculty at that time, and we used to have a 49ers days, which were in the springtime, and it's kind of a spring fling that most colleges had developed at one time or another. And it was kind of everything was in the lower campus, and we had a little bookstore and a fast food type service on the campus, and there was a little small quad or square that was crowded with 400 or 500 people, and it was crowded. And and the party and I would say that the 49er days at that point was a party, they would, people would, I remember somebody bringing a horse on campus and very gentle old horse, and everybody was climbing off and on the horse and so forth, and people wear costumes mostly with the 49er tradition, you know, the big hats, and some of the gals would come with the shawls and the I don't know what they call them. What do they call them? Sunbonnets, right? And the band would be there, and they'd have the cheerleaders and all that type of thing. And everybody knew, you know, it's not like today where you can walk halfway across the campus and not see anybody that you know. In those days, you couldn't walk anywhere without seeing somebody that you knew if you'd been around campus at all, because all of the activities. If you had a crowd of 100, you had most of, you know, the interested people there, because most of the people on campus in those early days were working, and they showed up for their classes and they left. But there was a nucleus of people that were involved. The Greek organizations were just getting started. While I was on campus, the first Greek organizations got national affiliation. Before then, the first 3 or 4 years, they had no affiliation. They were just local chapters with ideas of having national. I did not personally get involved with a fraternity because of the fact that I was older, and very frankly, the president of what became the SAE house was one of my close friends, and I had a standing invitation to all their parties, so I did it without paying dues. But anyway, the Greeks organizations started a social life on the campus that started to break the thing of people coming and going. There were a number of activities. Athletics, they started off the first year on campus in 1949, 1950 with a reasonably good basketball team. And there was a fellow by the name of Gene Amsbury who had played before he went in the service, and was, as I remember, he was 6'5 or 6'6, which was very big at the time for basketball players. And as a result, with a handful of other people that had grown up in Long Beach, a number of them I played basketball with, played on that 49-1950 team, and they started off and did quite well. So athletically, they played all the small colleges. They played Chapman, and they weren't big enough to play teams like Oxy, but they played all the little schools. They played Westmont and Santa Barbara, and all the little schools that you never hear about anymore were the ones that were their opponents for the first 3 or 4 years. They had no gymnasium. They used to use the old National Guard Armory, which is on 7th and Alameda in Long Beach, which happened to be in the same place at Wilson High School. Practice because Wilson High School did not have a gymnasium either at the same time. So the first athletic teams that had any notoriety at all was the basketball teams. The rest of the teams developed much slower athletically. The first football team was in 1955. Here again, many of the players on those teams that I had known from, they were high school players and they were older, and in fact, one of the starting halfbacks on that first football team was Gene Ashwell of Ashwell Burke, which is one of the large industrial real estate firms in the state of California now, and he was one of the football player, one of the, I don't know what they call him, a star, because the team wasn't that good, but he was one of the best players, of course, on the team. And the football team, here again, played all the little small colleges around. And I don't know, as I remember, they didn't do very well, but and they were working under very primitive conditions. They didn't have even full gym facilities or showers, but they did get started, they started a tradition that took many years to develop before they had good teams. The really good, fun teams to watch didn't take place until the early 60s, and when Dee Andrews, who was the first really good football player, played at the university, and his, I think it was 61 or 62 when he came out of high school and came and City College and came over here and was really the first really fine athlete football player that the university had. Of course, then it was, I call it university now, but it was a small college at the time. The campus, even in the couple of years that I was here, was growing at an unbelievable rate, and the growth was at that point, and I'm not sure of it, but it seemed like 20 or 25% a year the growth was. It was absolutely phenomenal. In the last few years, of course, in the 70s, early 70s and so forth, it was growing where there was maybe 1,000 more students each year. But back in those days, 1,000 students was like 25% of the campus population. There was kind of a family feeling about the faculty and some of the deans. One of my favorite people was Frenchie Flynn, and Frenchie Flynn did everything. He was a dean of students and head of planning, and he was a faculty sponsor of SAE on campus, and he had four or five jobs that he did, and there was a number of others that were the same way. They had David Bryant and Clarence Berglund, and each of them had two or three other things that they did besides their, like Clarence Berglund was a registrar, and he had two or three other things that he did. Everybody in the early days were involved with students more than just administration at that time. So there was kind of a family feeling there as I look back on it. And when the student activities would come out there, you would see 10 or 15% of the crowd, it seemed like, were faculty and administrative people there. The percentage of their participation in the social activities of the campus was far more prominent then because of the size of the campus. During the late 50s, I got involved back again in 57 and 58 with the Alumni Association. And how I did that was, as I graduated and I joined the Alumni Association, and the following year I didn't hear from them, and which would have been 57. So I finally saw some or talked to someone. I don't know exactly what the communication was, but I heard that they were having a board meeting so I came, suggested I come to the board meeting, and I came to complain because of the fact that they had no communication with me for a year. They never asked me for dues or anything else, and they all laughed and said, "That's our problem. We don't have any funds to do anything with. We don't have the help to get a hold of the graduates," and things are, of course, rapidly accelerating. You know, two or three years were, the first couple of years there was a couple of hundred graduates, then all of a sudden it was 1,000 graduates, and it was totally out of hand of keeping track of the alumni. So anyway, I came to complain, and I got laughed at and said, if I want to do something about it, I better get involved. So I came on the board of directors. It was like, if you were weak, you said, I do, and you were on the board at that time, because they needed all the bodies they could get to do the work. And I can remember spending 3 and 4 hours on an evening. We'd have a quick board meeting, and then we would start hand-addressing envelopes. And I can remember long about 58 or 59, through a little hocus-pocus of getting the university to buy us a piece of used equipment, which we in turn bought from the university. We bought a worn-out addressograph machine from the state surplus administration or whatever it is that passes on equipment to the lesser entities of which State College was one. So we bought this junk machine, and we ended up buying it the second time when we had it repaired. And I think we had $700 or $800 tied up in this terrible-looking machine that we, by this time, had gotten some off of. I want to get back to the. Let me finish this, and then I want to get back to something else. So anyway, we then the Alumni Association spent all of our money and all of our energy. Through volunteer and students being paid and everything else for making addressograph plates. And we made thousands of these things. We could hardly afford to buy the little plates at 10 cents a piece, for the thousands of graduates by this time. And, they're really starting to turn out the graduates of the university. And we spent all of our money and all of our efforts and everything else just trying to keep some kind of a line of communication and keep current addresses on the students. We did it all with no state funds. Okay, I want to back up and talk about the Alumni Association. When I first joined the Alumni Association, they were an accepted part of the university until about the time I graduated, and at that point, they took a stand on some faculty firings, the details of which I've long forgotten. And they took a stand against the president of the university. And Pete Peterson, who is the president of the university, threw the Alumni Association off campus. By that I mean he didn't physically do it. All he did is would not allow them facilities on campus and told them to find their home elsewhere if they were going to be, they were going to be anti-administration. So actually my first year or a couple of years on the board, we were kind of an underground organization, sneaking on campus to having our meetings, and we had our entire papers, and this was in 57, 58, 59, in a big briefcase. And that was the Alumni Association. I don't know who owned the briefcase, but that was the Alumni Association, the contents of the briefcase. And the briefcase was taken on and off campus, and finally we were able to sneak in and keep it. I think we kept it in the Associated Student offices, which at that time were in the bookstore. And we finally were given a desk drawer and a key for the desk drawer, which the contents of the briefcase went into. And Pete was to retire, and a new president of the university came on campus, and Carl McIntosh by name, and he and his lovely wife, Mary, came on campus, and one of the first things that he did was call the president of the Alumni Association, who was Larry Pierce at the time, and invite him to come in and talk to him, and he was astounded to find out there was no alumni office on campus, and that our total activities were in one desk drawer in the student senate offices. He immediately legitimatized or baptized or whatever you want to call it, the Alumni Association, and they were then in good standing with the university once again. And he helped us, assigned Ed Babish, who was the head of the, not the employment office, but the
placement
office, as sponsor kind of the Alumni Association. And we promptly moved into a desk, or a couple of two or three drawers and a desk, and a bootleg filing cabinet in the placement office. And this was about 1960-61, and we were then invited, the board of directors of the Alumni Association were invited to all of the major university functions, social functions, and so forth. And however, as President McIntosh started an advisory board, I believe Pete Peterson had started the advisory board, and then he of course had the advisory board started putting members of the community, well-known members of the community, and Carl was a fine public speaker, and got on the banquet circuit in Long Beach, and allowed a distinction between the campus on the hill and City College, which was the big college out in Lakewood, and it was at this time when the first few buildings that looked very very naked in their concrete with a little bit of brickwork. It was the state architects had stripped the original designs of Hugh Gibbs down to a more institutional look than the architect originally had. They called it the Mausoleum on the Hill because of the of this representative architecture that was on the campus late 50s and early 60s. Carl McIntosh, very interestingly, as he later on in the 60s, was pressured by the Alumni Association to put some of the alumni on his advisory board. At that time, didn't think that any of the alumni had succeeded in business enough to be on his advisory board. This didn't come into being until new president was named after Carl McIntosh had spent his 10 years on campus, and Stephen Horn. There was 1 year. I'm trying to think. Dr. Simonson was the president, interim president, while they hired Steve Horn. And once Dr. Horn came on campus as the new president, he then went ahead and put two alumni on the president's university advisory board. Jack Dilday and myself were named as on the advisory board, and I believe that was 1970. Well, anyway, back to the it's so easy to talk, Kay, and you can take one subject. And you saw what I did with the last subject. I went from the 50s right up to 70, you see. And it's difficult, to talk about the university and speak in generalities and bring it up current because there's so many events that are involved. Maybe I should stop now and ask you if I could unravel some of the confusion, or if there's any questions that I may have brought up.
Well, I'm still fascinated by the Alumni Association. you got to the point that you had a filing cabinet and a desk in the placement office.
Right, with our addressograph machine.
Oh, you had a place for your... Why did you keep the addressograph machine when you were off campus?
Well, I believe the timing on that was that we had the good graces of the college. This was after McIntosh when we got the addressograph machine, because we had the university had to buy it as from the state surplus, and then in turn we paid the university, and then they gave it to us. It was very interesting. You know, it wasn't until the mid-60s when the university started to first come on computer, I don't know the time, it must have been 63, 64, 5, somewhere along in there, when they finally came on computer, that we were able to eliminate the addressograph machine, which was a terrible, the cost of the plates and the storage of the plates when you start running into thousands of the plates. And the computer, of course, was able to store all that information on a couple of disks, and they started helping us because the job was absolutely overwhelming. When you start off with a little college of 4,000 or 5,000, turning out a few hundred graduates, to all of a sudden later on in the 60s, there was more graduates in a year than were on campus when I was a student. And all of a sudden, you get a new graduating list of 4,000, and the Alumni Association didn't have any money to deal with, because most of the graduates had only been out of school, less than 10 years, and many of them hadn't established themselves. And in the beginning, the dues of the Alumni Association were $3 a year. You could become a life member for $25 a year. And you could even break that down with $5 installments. And I think the current is $20 a year. It is $15 or $20 a year for membership now. Interestingly, I think I did mine on a five-year basis. And the sixth year, I was made president of the Alumni Association, which automatically gave me a life membership the year after I just paid for it. I don't know why it strikes me funny, but anyway, in the beginning, we had a few hundred members of the Alumni Association when I first got involved with it in '57, of which we could count on, a dozen or so for workers, and we seemed to burn out workers real fast. And the reason for it was we'd have these work sessions that last 4, 5, 6 hours. And a lot of people didn't make the muster for the second or third work session. We tried telephone campaigns and all kinds of things. One of the interesting things that happened outside the campus. The university was constantly being threatened by the politicians on budget, still is for that matter. And in one of the early times that the university was, the system, which it only became a system sometime after, I guess it was in the early 60s when it became a system. And all of a sudden, the chancellor's office and the board of trustees of the state college system, as it was known then, wanted some support and get the word out to the alumni. The fact is there were some budget cuts and some other things that were happening that the alumni should know about. And all of a sudden, the word got out that they were going to have a meeting in Northern California and a meeting in Southern California and get all of the alumni officers of the alumni associations of all of the campuses together and try to unite them together to go ahead and save the system. And I remember going to the meeting LA State, Cal State Los Angeles, Chuck Luckman, Charles Luckman, the architect, was the chairman of the board of trustees, and his first surprise when there was, I think there was only about 50 or 60 people that showed up at this meeting, and that was his first big surprise. And then his second big surprise was when he found out that the campuses, by law, were not allowed to help the alumni associations. They could absolutely provide no funds or help directly to the alumni associations. Well, the truth of the matter was that there was a little bootlegging of help, you know, a faculty or administrative representative to help take care of some of the problems that the alumni needed to have done. Some office space was made available, or in our case, drawer or desk space. But the rule was pretty well adhered to. There was no paid faculty or staff people involved with the alumni. The story that we told was the fact that with the rapid growth of the university, that we did not even have funds to keep up with the alumni. All we could do is make a one-shot mailing to graduates. Whoever would join, we would keep. And all of the others, we would keep the records of. But we could not continue them on a mailing. We would do an annual mailing only. We only had enough money to mail to them once. And then the next year, here come another 5,000. And even when it was stamps were 3 cents a piece, 5,000 3-cent stamps was a substantial part of our annual budget for the Alumni Association. So all of a sudden, I think there were five members of the Board of Trustees were absolutely astounded how the fact that the product of the university, the alumni, were not even, there was no communication with them by the university. There was no studies being made of what happened to the alumni, or any provision to do that. There was no monies available for it. What came out of these two or three meetings that followed was a little bit of liberalization, not necessarily by the state, but by the chancellor's office, to allow some things to happen that need to happen. That it was to the benefit of the university to maintain some sort of contact with the former students, the alumni, the graduates, and then this started happening. It was in the mid-60s when they finally went ahead and started helping, allowing the list to be maintained by the computer, and mailings and so forth were paid for by the alumni. But at least the list was serviced by the university. I'm not sure exactly at what point there were some small amounts of money that were allowed to filter through to do this, but it was sometime in the late 60s. The other activity I got started into, it must have been 1963 or 4. Frenchie Flynn came to the Alumni Association and said that the campus was at a size now that serious thought must be given to a student union. And we all agreed on the alumni board, and the result was that I started to serve on that committee. I don't know whether I volunteered. I'd like to think that I was smarter than just volunteered for that temporary position of helping form the needs assessment of the university, which is where it started off. But all I know is what did happen, and that was that year after year after year went by, and it later became a full committee, student union committee, and I served as the outside board member on that. And the next thing I know, that we ended up had plans for the building, and then we we couldn't get enough money, and we had to modify the building, and another year went by. And I remember the in 1968, with kind of the student rebellion year, they decided they wanted to tear out of the plans a space designated as the faculty lounge. And what happened was that it was renamed formal lounge and left in the plans, and no facility for the faculty was allowed in the building. And the building went under construction. I think it was in 69. It was about 3 years in construction. Completed in, I believe, 73. And I served another year and a half, I guess it was, on the board, on the operating board of the student union. And those were some great times where rules were being set. Two little events that happened that were significant after the fact of the student union. The first one was I was standing above the union looking down through it one afternoon, and a middle-aged lady had walked up to me, and we stopped and started a conversation, and she told me that her daughter had graduated a year or two before, and it was sad that she had not been there when the union was. And she said, it's nice that the university has now a heart. And boy, my heart kind of pumped real fast, and I'm sure my face got red, and I smiled, and I felt great pride in the fact that the building was completed. The other significant thing happened was at a one of the first events in the building, I made some comment about the fact that I had been there and kind of a gentle put down the fact I'd been there and through the thing and I don't know exactly how I worded it, but Lois Dean Swanson, that was a dean of students, I guess, at the time, turned on me and she says, Marvin, she says, do you realize that most people never in their life get involved with anything of this stature, and you saw the thing all the way through. And I one more time was embarrassed, but for a different reason. And she just, really laid it on me. The fact is that I should not downgrade, such an effort. And I stood there, rather ashen-faced, and realized that I was so close to it, I didn't realize the significance of it. And those are the two things that I remember in particular. About the student union. The other things that I know I personally got involved with was and it kind of tells a little bit of the story of the university. The first outside support activity for the football team was a barbecue, and we had hamburger and handful of the alumni went ahead, and we had hamburgers and tossed salad, and I forget what else. And Doug Ritchie helped provide. We got the hamburgers off campus through Friend of the Meat Business, and got that at a very low cost. And we had this hamburger feed and fed the football team. We had a couple of barbecues the university owned and we put some lights out on the back of the, there's a couple of handball back deals in the maintenance department. Put a couple of temporary lights out there, and we fed the football team hamburger. Within 3 years, we were able to feed them steak. So that just kind of shows you how things went. In the very beginning, there was what we were trying to do was get one alumni and to pay for himself, for his meal, plus a football player. The first year we didn't make it, but we eventually went ahead and were able to have steak, and the thing worked out real well.
And that type of activity was later picked up by the 49er booster group. And I guess I was Bob Hoding, who was a past president of the Alumni Association, was the first alumni to join that group. It was started by some business people in Long Beach, and I was the second alumni member of the 49er booster, which is now the 49er Athletic Foundation, which I'm still a member of. The other activities that, of course, one of the fun things, my son, who's now a student in engineering, always calls the Bellflower Gate Daddy's Gate. And the story behind that was that we had complained at an alumni association that the entrance on Bellflower was not well marked. There was a little state sign that looked like some sort of a road sign, like, you know, do not litter the highways or something. That was kind of a sign. It was black and white and very official looking, and that was it said Long Beach State College in very small letters, and people could drive right by and not see it. So anyway, we talked about doing it, and Frenchie Flynn, who was the advisor of the, this had to have been in the late 50s, said that's a good idea. And so we went ahead and we figured out that we could get plywood and a bunch of other materials donated, and I had sought some help on getting a sign made. And our first estimate was $200 to build the sign on Bellflower, all donated material.